From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Former State Senator Molly Kelly announces her bid for governor of New Hampshire, bringing the number of Democrats in the race up to two. Marcy's Law is vigorously debated in the New Hampshire legislature, and so is legislation that would merge the definitions of residency and domicile for voting purposes. And the New Hampshire Red is likely to become the official state poultry. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. And you can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That is 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And we are streaming a live video of this radio show, so it is very easy to listen and watch. You can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Dave Solomon of the Union Leader. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Good morning, Peter.
Again, listeners, phone number for you to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. So Molly Kelly joined the race for governor this week. Dave, why does she want to be governor?
Well, she has a well-regarded career in the Senate. She's got a lot of backing by some of the leading incumbent Democratic lawmakers. She is kind of a classic candidate, Democratic candidate for governor in the mold of Maggie Hassan and Jeanne Shaheen, both of whom translated very successful senatorial careers into gubernatorial tenure. She probably will have a tough fight in the primary against Mr. Marchand, the Portsmouth mayor, who's already run and has carved out a space for himself in the more to the left Bernie Sanders wing of the party. It'll be interesting to see in the primary how both of them play to the pledge against broad-based taxes, which is in the past has separated Democratic primary candidates. The Jackie Silley, who ran against Hassan in the primary and did her primary, didn't take the pledge. Hassan did. Democrats seem to have come to the realization that it's going to be hard enough to elect anyone against Chris Sununu, let alone one who doesn't take the pledge. So that is going to be a dynamic in the campaign. It appears both of them intend to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Molly Kelly spoke earlier this week on All Things Considered about what sets her apart from her primary opponent, Steve Marchand.
I know how to work with legislators. I know how difficult it is to get legislation passed. I know how to make difficult decisions. A lot of my experience in the Senate has prepared me to be governor, and this is the moment I will seize and to move forward running a very hard grassroots campaign.
Very hard grassroots campaign from Molly Kelly. Dean, how does she compare to Steve Marchand in your view?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Dave was correct that Steve has staked out an increasingly progressive agenda as a gubernatorial candidate. We know he ran for governor the last time around, received some criticism from progressives that he was tacking to the left in order to have a bigger impact in the primary. He had a pretty good run. He felt like he got in a little bit late. So as a result, this time he's been in very early. He's been campaigning for a long time already going around the state. He's going to paint Molly Kelly as the establishment candidate. She's been endorsed by Kathy Sullivan, the former party chair, former Congressman Paul Hodes, former House Speaker Terry Norelli. So he's going to say she's part of the Democratic establishment and not sufficiently progressive.
Is there some truth to that claim?
Well, I mean, she traditionally has been viewed as a moderate. She's taking some issue with that picture of her, but she does have a lot of the sort of institutional elites lined up with her. So I think it's a reasonable tact for Marchand to take. It'd be interesting to see how kind of progressive and left of center the primary electorate is this time around in the upcoming primary in September. Now, we mentioned the pledge, and our friend Paul Steinhauser was just doing some reporting on this yesterday. And if you follow him on Twitter, his reporting suggests that Molly Kelly, who apparently perhaps did not take the pledge in the past, but regardless has said this time that she will take the pledge, that she will not increase sales or income tax. Marchand has said that he is not interested in increasing sales or income tax, but he is not officially taking any sort of pledge, just as he did not the last time around. So how they kind of finesse this, which has typically been a third rail for politicians in recent decades in New Hampshire, is going to be a big part of the primary race. Republicans are going to paint both of them as tax and spend liberals, regardless of whatever they might say during the primaries.
Mm-hmm. What about the fact that she's joining the race now? Is it too early, too late? What do you think?
I think it was getting close to being too late. I think she can probably still get in, and we'll see how effective she is at raising money. I think there's a lot of Democratic energy in this cycle for obvious reasons, given the unhappiness among Democrats with President Trump and an all-Republican controlled legislature and governorship. So there may be some money out there to be had. It's, you know, Governor Sununu has got good popularity. New Hampshireites may split tickets in some respects. We have a Democratic congressional delegation, but a Republican governor. So that could happen again. I think the best bet for either of these candidates is that it's a sufficiently large Democratic wave in the midterm to knock Governor Sununu out as well. We don't know that that's going to happen, but I think that's sort of the best case scenario for them, given his popularity level.
Well, it hasn't happened since, 2004 with Craig Benson?
Benson lost to John Lynch in 2004, which was not a Democratic wave. It was sort of the sort of pre-wave. The real Democratic wave was 2006. 2004, John Lynch won, but we didn't see the huge Democratic gains until 2006.
Dave?
John Lynch was the only top of the ticket Democrat to survive the Republican wave of 2010, yeah. And a lot of the good betting political money is that if there is a big Democratic wave, Sununu will probably repeat that survival as the last Republican standing in senior office in New Hampshire. He's in very good shape right now, as evidenced of all the polls and his success in positioning himself as somewhat of a moderate yet very loyal to the Republican platform.
He's been very good at kind of carving out that space. This is what we used to call triangulation with Bill Clinton. You kind of you service your party, but you also take care of the independents in the middle. And then you sort of most people or a majority of people are happy with you, even though you're always going to have a vocal opposition in the other party at some level.
Well, speaking of the November elections, we know one person isn't going to be running now. Big news this week. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan has decided that he's just going to retire and has some folks in New Hampshire wondering, including Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, what is this going to mean for CD1, the big toss-up race in New Hampshire? Does this, as Kevin asserts in his article, Dave, really increase the importance of CD1?
Yeah, he made a good case in his Granite Status column yesterday that Republicans may be much more likely to pay more attention to the CD1 race, which is wide open because of Carol Shea Porter's decision not to run. The race was already getting a lot of attention, but with Ryan's decision, it's going to probably get a lot more money and a lot more manpower from the national Republican apparatus for two reasons. They certainly want to make sure they flip it to a Republican seat, and they potential speaker candidates would love to have the loyalty of that new Republican congressman in their bid to replace Paul Ryan. And it becomes important to flip that District 1 seat to Republican in New Hampshire because there's a good chance that Ryan's seat could flip to Democrat. He's got a very serious blue challenger who's positioned himself as a blue-collar, a middle-of-the-road Democrat, the kind that we've seen succeed in other off-cycle races in the past year.
So go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that we're going to see that much of a difference as a result of this. This seat, as Dave mentioned, is already hotly contested. There was already an assumption that there was going to be a lot of Republican money put into this. I don't know that Paul Ryan leaving in January changes that significantly. The leadership succession in the GOP and Congress is largely set. Kevin McCarthy, who had originally been in line to be Speaker of the House after John Boehner, had to step away because of some comments he made about Hillary Clinton during the last election that were highly politicized. He's kind of done his time, and I think now he's ready to step back up. Steve Scalise, the second in command, has already said he would not challenge McCarthy for the speakership or minority leader should they lose the House in November. So this is not any sort of big leadership shakeup. There is some interest in whether or not Ryan would step down from the speakership, even if he stays into January, just to allow Republicans to move forward. I don't know that he's willing to do that. So it's already a hotly contested race. I mean, there's probably some truth to the idea that these other individuals like McCarthy and Scalise maybe come up here and are a little more interested in the seat. But in the end, Democrats need 23 seats, and there's a reasonably good chance that they will do that. And I think I don't know that Ryan making this announcement really changes it all that much. I think we sort of already know what the dynamic's going to be in November.
Well, certainly worth mentioning because the CD1 race is very important for New Hampshire voters. Along those lines, I do want to mention part of the program that we're doing for Monday. We're continuing our Race for the First series with candidates for the first congressional district, sitting down with them for a segment of the program to get to know who they are and where they stand. Next up, Democrat Eglin McEachran. That is on Monday, April 16th, and you can send your questions to the candidate to exchange@nhpr.org. This is the Weekly News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Coming up on the show, a discussion of a law that would merge the definitions of domicile and residency for voting purposes. What do you think should happen with respect to this law, to New Hampshire's voting laws? Does this law in particular disenfranchise college students, as some allege? Or, as some allege, is it a necessary clarification of the law or something else? We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange@nhpr.org. So also on Capitol Hill in Washington this week, New Hampshire senators had opportunities to question a couple of very powerful people, those people powerful for very different reasons. Senator Jean Shaheen participated in the hearing questioning President Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. She was questioning him, and let's hear that.
Do you think Special Counsel Mueller's investigation is a witch hunt?
Ma'am, I'm going to not speak about any of the three investigations that I have been a participant in today.
Do you think the president has the authority, recognizing your legal background, does the president have the authority to fire Special Counselor Mueller on his own?
Senator, I'm in no position to make a comment on that legal question.
So didn't exactly get answers to those questions, but important nonetheless to know what Senator Shaheen is caring about.
Yeah, it was certainly a tough hearing for Mr. Pompeo. This is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Jean Shaheen had voted yes on his confirmation as the head of the CIA. So there's some question about whether or not she will vote yes again. She met with him in advance on Tuesday. He's been doing kind of a tour around Congress to try to get some support. He's in a tough spot. Rand Paul, senator, has said he will not support him. John McCain is away dealing with his cancer diagnosis. So it potentially puts the Republicans in the position of needing at least one Democrat to get a tie so that Vice President Pence could break a potential tie. If he does not get a favorable nomination coming out of the committee, typically secretaries of state are not confirmed in the general vote. That could still happen. But he's very hawkish. The kinds of answer is sort of what you heard. Senator Shaheen asked another question about how he felt about the Russia investigation. Did he agree with President Trump that it was a hoax? He kind of gave a non-answer. He has been a little more aggressive towards pushing back on Russia than President Trump has. So it's a question. Gene Shaheen's philosophy has typically been what you hear from a lot of senators historically, which is, I may not agree with what the individual says in terms of policy, but if they have the proper qualifications, I'm willing to say yes. I think as we become more polarized as a country and Congress has become more polarized, that's less of what we typically see, but I think she still operates under that philosophy. She may not agree with him, but if she thinks he's qualified, she may vote yes. And so given that she voted yes for him the first time for CIA, we're waiting to see if she's going to go in the other direction this time.
As she was quoted in one story I read, that it's a different job.
So that is true.
Different requirements. Yep. So jury's still out on that, apparently. So we'll have to stay on top of that story. Also in the news this week, actually for 2 days, Facebook CEO and founder Mark Zuckerberg was questioned by members of Congress, among them Senator Maggie Hassan.
So will you commit to working with Congress to develop ways of protecting constituent privacy and well-being, even if it means that that results in some laws that will require you to adjust your business model?
Senator, yes. We will commit to that. I think that that's an important conversation to have.
Definitive answer from Mark Zuckerberg. Senator Hassan should be happy.
Yeah, this is an interesting couple days of hearings. The first day in front of the Senate was resoundingly trolled on social media as trying to explain to your grandparents how the internet works. The questions were, for the most part, quite weak and evidenced a lack of understanding of how social media works by a lot of these elderly members of the Senate. Not all of them, but a number of them. The House, I think, was prepared with a little bit of a tougher Given that, the House was prepared for a little bit of a tougher questioning. You know, the one of the theories out there that people can evaluate is the idea that Facebook is so big that in some sense putting in place a regulatory regime might actually help them block out other up-and-coming competition. Hmm. That they're so big at this point that even if you change the rules now, it's going to hurt other potential. Rather than create a marketplace in which there are lots of other options, this could actually hamper the development of other options. That's one theory we're hearing out there, which is why you hear Zuckerberg quickly say yes. Now, he may genuinely feel that something needs to be done, but I've also seen a number of people make the case that from a business perspective, a regulatory regime at this point wouldn't necessarily hurt them given how big they are. I mean, they've got something like over 2 billion users worldwide, which is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, like 2.2
or something like that. Oh, even
planet.
More. Yeah, it's crazy.
And interesting that you mentioned the regulations shutting out competition, because some of the senators were questioning him specifically on whether or not Facebook was a monopoly.
No.
So what is your competition, Mr. Zuckerberg? And he's kind of stumbled through the question on that. Last thing to discuss before the break really quickly. 2 years ago, an emissions rigging scandal prompted a $15 billion settlement between Volkswagen and the U.S. government. Now, Chris Sununu has proposed on how to spend New Hampshire's share. How does Governor Sununu want to spend this money, Dave?
Well, there, when these funds became available, and New Hampshire is going to get about $30 million, the terms of the settlement, as dictated by the judge, required the state to spend the money for certain purposes that would contribute to cleaner air and kind of reverse some of the pollution caused by the overpolluting Volkswagens. And so they fell into two broad categories: do things to promote the development of electric vehicles in your state, or do things to retire old diesel fuel burning vehicles in your fleet. A lot of the environmental groups pushed for a huge focus on electric vehicle conversion, charging station infrastructure, and the like. A lot in the industry, the truck and municipalities supported the idea of fleet replacement. It was a chance for them to get a lot of their old DPW trucks off the road, replaced with new, more efficient trucks at no cost to the municipality. In the end, Sununu split it right down the middle. The fund will go about halfway in each direction.
Or at least so far, right? The plan's open for comment
until June,
right? I'm sorry,
that's the proposed plan, yeah, which is now open for comment before finalization.
All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Dave Solomon of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital. NHPR's Jason Moon is going to join us after the break. If you'd like to join the conversation about the week's news, the number to call is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, which is where we've got a live video of this broadcast going on right now. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital. Dave Solomon, the union leader, and NHPR's Jason Moon is with us now. He's going to talk about a few stories that he's reported on this week. Thanks for being here, Jason.
Good morning.
Really appreciate it. Before we get into some of the stories that you've been reporting on, Jason, I want to bring listeners up to speed on a story that's been evolving sort of in the public sphere for the past couple of weeks. You may recall last week we talked about Dr. Michael Mayo Smith's letter to the editor in the Concord Monitor. Dr. Mayo Smith was the leader of the New England VA network. And since he has retired, he retired in early March, he's been able to speak publicly about what has been happening at the Manchester VA, some of the things that he revealed in his op-ed and then in the subsequent interview with NHPR was that he did know about some of the problems with the Manchester VA, but that he was instructed by Central Office in D.C. not to speak about them publicly. He also made some comments about one of the whistleblowers who happens to be running for Congress, and that whistleblower is on the line with us now, Stuart Levinson. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
I understand that you have some comments about what Dr. Mayo Smith had to say.
Yes, I find it interesting. He starts his editorial that he was unable to speak up because the VA central office told him to keep quiet so the controversy would fade from public interest. So he's complaining that he wasn't able to speak his mind because he was too involved in the cover-up of it. So that's the first thing. The second is that here he's claiming he didn't know when evidence was presented at a public hearing where at the end the chairman, you were there yourself, said that his leadership was lacking. So we have a disgraced former network director, and throughout the week, coordinated attacks have occurred on me, and I believe it's because of my independent view in running for Congress in the 2nd Congressional District. I mean, the Concord Monitor is a great paper, but these letters came from all over the country, so I think it sort of goes against belief that people from all over the country are following this one story.
So just to bring listeners up to speed, Stuart, just really quickly, Thursday this week in the Concord Monitor, a couple of supporters of Dr. Mayo Smith wrote in to the Concord Monitor, spelled out that he did an honorable job. Your letter to the editor in response was also published beside those. Let me ask you specifically about one of the comments made directed at you and get you on the record for this one, Stuart. He alleged that this has been politicized by your running for Congress. In short, that your status as a whistleblower was leveraged in this campaign. Do you? What do you have to say to that?
I just think that's ridiculous. I mean, the fact that I had been trying to bring issues to light for probably the last dozen years, working through channels. And then when that didn't work, I met with Congresswoman Custer, who turned a blind eye privately, whatever she says publicly. And the fact that these attacks are occurring right now, that's just one of these empty attacks because I'm an outsider that is going to rock the boat in Washington.
Well, Stuart, thank you very much for speaking with me. I really appreciate you calling in and lending in your insight into this conversation. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Listeners, if you've got questions about the week's news, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking about the HB 1264 in the New Hampshire House that attempts to merge definitions of domicile, resident, and inhabitant. Some say it will make it difficult for college students to vote. Others say it's simply a clarification. It's not going to disenfranchise anyone. We want to know what you think. Your voice matters. Please give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Before we get into that, though, we want to talk a little bit about Marcy's Law. Marcy's Law is a proposed amendment to the state constitution that is designed to give victims of crimes greater say in the court system by enshrining a list of constitutional rights. Jason Moon, you've been reporting on this. Tell us, what are those rights that they hope to enshrine in the Constitution under Marcy's Law?
Well, it's a list of things, many of which are already in state statute, but they include things like the right to reasonable protection from the accused, the right to be notified of court proceedings on the same basis as the accused, the right to be heard during a sentencing hearing or to confer with the prosecutor in a plea deal negotiation, things like that, you know, over the past several a couple decades, really, victims of crimes have been advocating for more say in those things because they say in some situations they get re-victimized by the court system. They suffer at the hands of the accused, and then they get the runaround from the court system, and their voice isn't heard. And so this is an attempt to sort of, you know, give them a seat at the table, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. On the exchange Wednesday, Republican Representative John Hunt said some of his House colleagues are wondering if victims' rights changes should be made through legislation instead.
I have mixed emotions. I certainly don't have a problem passing a constitutional amendment, but generally I've never had an opportunity where a constitutional amendment was so far-reaching, so expansive.
And former state Supreme Court Justice Carol Ann Conboy testified against Marcy's law, warning that the amendment could undermine due process in part by recognizing someone as a victim before a trial has taken place.
Until that other person is legally proven to be responsible for the crime, the victim is in fact and law only an alleged victim.
And Jason, this is an argument that the ACLU of New Hampshire is making as well, right? That it's not a victim yet. It's an alleged victim until there's a verdict in court.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting sort of constitutional issues that get raised with this amendment. And I think it's important to point out that opponents to the amendment, they're not necessarily arguing that these situations don't happen where victims aren't treated with respect by the court system. There are situations where that something happens that shouldn't have. The real debate here is whether a constitutional amendment is the way to address the issue. As I said earlier, a lot of these rights are already in statute. Supporters say they need them to be in the Constitution so that they're equal to the rights of the accused and that will sort of balance the playing field. But opponents say this is really more about implementation. It's more about an administrative, bureaucratic fix that's needed, more funding for victims' advocates in the courts, things like that, not a constitutional amendment, which opponents say is too far-reaching, is too specific, and that if the argument goes, if we include this amendment with such specific language and then, 3, 5, 7 years down the road, we discover some problem, some unintended consequence, it's really hard to take it out because it's in the Constitution. New Hampshire has a very high bar for constitutional amendments relative to other states. It takes 3/5 in both houses. Keeping in mind the House has 400 members, 3/5 is a lot of votes. And then it also takes 2/3 of citizen voters in the November election. So you got to be, opponents say you got to be really careful about what you put in because if it's if there's unintended consequences, it's hard to take out.
And among those who spoke out in favor of Marcy's law as a constitutional amendment is this woman who left us a voicemail, who's a victim of sexual assault. She spoke in favor of Marcy's law.
My name is Paula, and I'm a survivor of childhood sexual abuse between the ages of 3 and 11. And yesterday I testified in support of Marcy's law for New Hampshire. It is extremely important that we get this on the ballot for November. It protects the rights of the victims. Currently, we do have a Bill of Rights. However, it is always outweighed by the constitutional rights of the accuser. So we would like to have Marcy's Law become constitutional law so that every victim will have a voice. Thank you.
So that's the word from a supporter of Marcy's law becoming a constitutional amendment. Dean, did you want to weigh in on this?
It's been following this. It's very interesting. I think the challenge for opponents of this is that, 2/3 of it seems to be moving through the legislature pretty quickly, and Governor Sununu said he supports it. You need, as Jason mentioned, you need 2/3 of voters to approve it in November. The arguments being made in opposition to it are sort of fairly specific constitutional, procedural, and process issues. And I'm really wondering, the average voter is going to say, sure, victims' rights. Victims need to have rights too. And that's going to be kind of the extent of it. So I think that the disadvantage for opponents is that the case for opposing this is based on these very specific procedural, potentially unintended consequences. The average voter is not really going to be that plugged into them, and I think that's a challenge for opponents.
The other thing on the supporters' side is that this is a a nationwide campaign. Yeah, this is not right. This is funded by a California tech billionaire named Henry Nicholas, who's already passed this or a similar amendment in other states. And you know that they say they're planning to spend millions of dollars getting it passed here. So there's a lot of not only political support behind it, but there's financial support.
A lot of very dramatic stories about victims exactly. and their rights. And so this is a challenging playing field for the opponents of this.
Well, one thing that will work to the advantage of the opposition is the sheer length of the amendment. One of the reasons constitutional amendments are hard to pass is because people go into the voting booth to check a name, not to read a 16-page single-spaced document, and I think the complexity of it could actually work against its passage.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with our guest today about the week's news. Still to come, sexual harassment at the State House. An investigation by the AP has found that there have been 8 complaints against 6 House members since 2015. What questions do you have about this story? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, where there's a live video of this broadcast being broadcast right now. You can check it out there. Also, we'll be talking about climate change and the threat of sea level rise on the seacoast. Jason Moon here has been reporting on that report and talking to people who are knowledgeable about the situation. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but we do need to talk about this voting bill, HB 1264, because it was so important to so many people this week, and Dave, you were reporting on this for the Union Leader, that they actually had to move the hearing to a larger room to accommodate all the people.
Students have been really mobilized on this because this whole issue of voting rights and voting suppression has become one of the litmus test issues that divides the different ideological positions these days. And it is really was in evidence at that hearing when such a large crowd of students and their supporters from the League of Women Voters and so forth tried to crowd into the small meeting room and were told by the chairman, this is the only room we have. They continued to press for more space. At one point, the ranking Democrat in the Senate, Jeff Woodburn, who was also on the election committee, started pounding the table and in a very loud voice virtually demanding that the hearing be moved to another room.
And so it was.
It was. The Senate president commented on the Senate floor yesterday. He made a call for more decorum among members and more civility between each other, as has been the Senate's tradition. He wouldn't explain to me what prompted that, but the speculation among many of the senators themselves, it was that situation in that meeting room.
Okay. Well, Republican State Senator Jeb Bradley on The Exchange this week, he tried to downplay concerns over this bill and what people are concerned about. Let's hear what he had to say.
Nobody is going to be denied the opportunity to vote. We have instituted voter ID. There were a lot of the same arguments that were used opposing voter ID several years ago, but now it is routine. Virtually everybody seems to support it. We want to make sure that people that vote in New Hampshire are able to vote in New Hampshire. And so by saying to somebody who maybe temporarily domiciled here, if you're going to vote here, you should take measures to become a resident here. That's all that's being asked of.
And Democratic State Senator Dan Feltes on The Exchange said he sees the bill redefining residency for voting entirely different from what Senator Bradley just expressed. He sees it as setting up barriers and reflecting a partisan agenda.
Senator Bradley said, all the bills do is require you to take measures. Well, those measures of registering a car, getting a driver's license cost money, and that constitutes, in many people's view, an unconstitutional poll tax on voting in the state of New Hampshire. And we ought to be doing everything we can to include people in our democracy, young people, seniors who may not have a car or driver's license. And it's about attracting and retaining people here in the state of New Hampshire, not setting up barriers that may disenfranchise people from participating in democracy. Let's focus on the real problems.
Okay, so called it a poll tax. Is that something you heard a lot, Dave?
I think it depends on your interpretation. It's important for people to understand how we got to this place. And most people will say, why isn't there a residency requirement for voting? Most states say you have to be a resident of this precinct to vote here. And this situation has come about because of the definition of residency as it currently exists on the books in New Hampshire, which loosely phrased states that it's the place that by all your actions and deeds you've demonstrated a determination to stay to the exclusion of all other places for the indefinite future. And a court case was challenged.
Those four words, for the indefinite future.
Well, the whole residency requirement was challenged by voters, I think, in 2012. And the judge ruled at the time this is unconstitutional because defining residency as where you're going to be for the indefinite future is too high of a standard for a constitutional right to vote. So the residency requirement was struck down. And since then, New Hampshire's been operating on the basis of domicile, where you live now, regardless of where you intend to be forever. Many, particularly in Republican ranks, have felt that's too loose. It needs to be where you plan to live. And so this bill and a similar bill working its way through the Senate removes those four words, for the indefinite future, in the hope that New Hampshire can then impose a residency requirement that will pass the inevitable court tests. So that's all this bill does. It removes those words. Now, the argument becomes, well, the law requires that if you're a resident of New Hampshire, you have 60 days to get your car registered here, get a driver's license, a state identification, and so forth, if you so choose. Mm-hmm. So the key here, and what has hardly ever raised, is it's all about the implementation. Just as we've heard as regards to Marcy's Law and so many other things, in that Maine, for example, has a residency requirement. But the residency requirement for voting is not translated to enforcement by the Department of Motor Vehicles. In fact, the governor in the state of Maine, in an election 2 years ago, sent a letter to all the colleges saying, remember, if you vote, you're going to have to get a driver's license and register your car in this state. And the Secretary of State, who happens to be a Democrat in Maine, sent out a letter within hours saying, oh, no, don't worry. These things aren't cross-checked. They're not. There's no integration of enforcement between election law and motor vehicle law. When this question is raised with Bill Gardner and the election officials in the state as to how they will enforce this requirement should it ever be passed into law, it's acknowledged that, well, we haven't really talked about that. So these students are worried that if I say I'm registered, I'm making a statement that I'm a citizen, a resident of New Hampshire, and will have to register my vehicle here. That's true if they want to obey the law, but the only way that we can see for the time being that would be enforced on the ground is the way it's always enforced. A police officer stops you, says, where do you live? You say, I live in New Hampshire. He looks at your mass license and says, okay, I'm putting you in the computer. You've got 60 days to get a New Hampshire license. Outside of that, it's hard to understand how that would be enforced. So on the one hand, it does impose a requirement if you're the kind of person who's going to do what the law requires you to do, whether or not there's an enforcement mechanism. But on the other hand, it's not going to create a scenario where once you register your vote, your name goes into a computer where you're going to get a notice in 60 days.
Okay. And we've got calls on this issue as well, and I want to take them after the break. If you've already called, stay on the line. We want to bring your question into the conversation. If you haven't called yet, but you have a question, we'll stay on this voting topic a little bit longer. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email works too, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, where, again, we've got a video of this broadcast going on. Nice, cool little feature. Check it out, NHPR Exchange on Facebook. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We will be right back.
I listen to NHPR a lot.
Which is why Scott Brown of Franklin is a sustaining member of NHPR's Leadership Circle.
Trust, dedication, integrity, those are values that I see from top to bottom in NHPR, and we're just proud to be a part of the family.
You too can become a part of NHPR's Leadership Circle when you invest $100 a month into the statewide news service you trust. Join the family at nhpr.org/leadershipcircle.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Dave Solomon, reporter for the Union Leader, and NHPR's Jason Moon. And with you, give us a call to discuss the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We didn't quite finish our discussion of HB 1264, which would merge the definitions of domicile, residency, and inhabitant. We've got some calls, and we want to see if we can get to some of those and answer your questions. Michael is calling from Manchester. Michael, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yes, hi. Thank you. I'm calling. I understand that there's some political spectrum difference of perception of what the intent of the new House bill on proving domicile and residence. In my interpretation, it seems that on one side, it's aiming to restrict voter behavior as a way to, quote-unquote, right the ship. And on the other side, there's recommendations to incentivize good behavior to right the ship. I see the restriction angle as the electorate, and I see the incentivization side as growing the electorate, or perhaps more healthily representing the full electorate of New Hampshire.
Okay, and Michael. Well,
your speakers can speak about that.
Sure, I'll put it to the panel. So, question about intent: is it intent to restrict, or intent to incentivize, to shrink, or to grow? Dave, what do you think?
Well, I think the supporters of these measures would argue it is not an attempt to constrict or enlarge the electorate, but to ensure that only people who are entitled to vote by virtue of their residency status are able to vote on a given election. Although it's fairly apparent that if the more rules and barriers you impose, the more hoops you have to jump through, the more people who are just going to throw up their hands and walk away from the registration point. So it is hard to deny that whatever the intention is, the ultimate effect of a bill like the two we're discussing will be to diminish voter numbers to some extent.
Jason?
And I think we should just raise the argument from the opponents, one argument from the opponents, which is that this is fixing a problem that doesn't really exist. I mean, one of the arguments is this will just sort of simplify the law. But in terms of, you know, actual cases of, you know, people voting who shouldn't have, you know, it's the evidence is you know, few and far between. Just to plug our own Casey McDermott's great reporting on that topic, looking back, you know, through years of cases where, you know, wrongful voting was investigated, and you know, the situations where it happens are kind of delightfully innocent in terms of relative to what we sometimes hear about in the rhetoric versus reality, as she put it in the story.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the issue with all of this legislation, whether we go back to SB3, which is now in the courts, or the HB 372, or the other bill as well, you know, the issue is what comes after the vote. Still, you know, we have same-day registration. We've heard supporters of the bill say that people will still be able to vote. But the issue is, as I think Dan Felty's mentioned in his comment, what comes after and whether or not that will be an unconstitutional disincentive to vote. And, you know, just for example, I've been teaching students here in New Hampshire for over 20 years. To the extent that they want to vote, they want to be part of the community, they're not looking to get New Hampshire driver's licenses and register their cars. They're going to go back eventually to Massachusetts. They may decide to stay at some point or wherever else they come from. And I think that's part of the issue. It will have a negative impact on particularly college students, people who are here temporarily. And so that's the battle. And I think, you know, Democrats will take this to the courts and argue that the stuff that you have to do afterwards is an unconstitutional poll tax, and that they have standing because it's going to reduce people who are likely to vote Democratic, because a lot of young voters vote Democratic. So, you know, we're going to be talking about this stuff for a while, even if it makes its way through the legislature.
Okay, one more call on this. Let's go to Lucy in Lancaster. Lucy, thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to underscore what's been said several times already, but I was riding over here I'm in my car. I was listening to the news this morning, and I was struck by comments earlier about the aging of New Hampshire, and now this discussion, which talks about, in my opinion, this bill would discourage young people from staying in New Hampshire. Certainly, we don't know what their plans are, but if they're allowed to vote and participate in the process, they're much more likely to become invested, and this may have a benefit to our quote-unquote aging state. So thank you. I'm opposed to this bill for various other reasons, but thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Thanks, Lucy. Thank you very much, and thanks to everyone who called in on this. We do have to move on, but coverage of this issue and many others can be found at nhpr.org, and remember, the discussion does continue on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Jason, want to touch base with you on a couple of important stories that you were reporting on this week, including the study out of UNH that shows that some seacoast historic sites are threatened by sea level rise. What's the story behind this report?
Yeah, it's interesting work by an anthropology professor at the University of New Hampshire, and it's a simple concept. Basically, she just takes the location of known historic sites on the seacoast and overlays that on a map with sea level rise projections and kind of quantifies what may be at risk. And what she's come up with is, if you look at the sort of some of the higher sea level rise scenarios, up to 14% of the historic sites on the seacoast could be at risk, including really well-known sites like Strawberry Bank and Odeyourn Point. But most interesting to me was also it's threatening sites that we haven't yet discovered yet, archaeological sites from early colonial settlers. And she, in fact, just found a site last year, a site of where a garrison house once stood in Durham. New Hampshire history buffs will know garrison houses are a sort of fortified log cabin that were built when this was kind of the frontier of settled, you know, European settled land. And she had an old map from the 1600s and went out to find the archaeologic site of this garrison house. And then she got there and found most of the site has already eroded away. It's already lost. And this is a site that's along the Oyster River in Durham, where it's been known and you know, there's been concern for a while about growing storm surges is kind of eating away at this coastline. So, you know, it's a very kind of specific and striking example of what is at risk and is already, you know, already being lost.
And confirming the worst fears of environmentalists who have been speaking about this for years now.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that you might not necessarily think about being at risk. You know, often we're talking about roads getting flooded out or basements being flooded or, you know, beaches being eroded away. But here you have history that's been here for, you know, almost 400 years. And it's surprising that we haven't, you know, discovered some of these sites in the first place. But the fact that we might lose them before we do is, I think, concerning to a whole, you know, for a whole different reason.
Yeah, scary proposition for a lot of people, especially those historically inclined. Also in the news this week, you've been reporting, Jason, you cover education-related issues as well. So the Executive Council approved more than $4 million in state-funded scholarships on Wednesday. How's this money going to be divided up?
Yeah, this is a program that was pushed by Governor Sununu. It was he emphasized it, and I believe it was included in his budget proposal. It got a mention in his State of the State speech. It's one of, you know, several ploys to address this issue that the caller raised, in fact, which, you know, getting young people to stay in New Hampshire, kind of addressing the workforce issues, the aging state, demographic issues.
So to give New Hampshire students money for New Hampshire colleges.
Exactly, to
keep
stay
them
here.
Here.
Exactly, to stay here. In that sense, it was pretty uncontroversial, but there was a kind of a last-minute concerns raised by some, including the ACLU, that some of the money would be spent at religious schools. That argument didn't stop the vote from the Executive Council. It went through. But it's interesting in that it's sort of the exact argument that we will hear if the Education Savings Account bill is passed. And it's this question of whether if the money, you know, if the money comes through a scholarship to a student, to a family, and then that family then decides to use that, you know, funding at a religious school, does that violate state constitutional, provisions that prohibit public funding from going to religious schools? Mm-hmm. The Attorney General thinks it doesn't, but some think it you know, some would argue otherwise.
And the Democrats on the Executive Council voted against it because they wanted more time to look at it, was it? Or
that was, yes, that was the argument that we should have a full legal review of that issue.
Dave?
Well, it's interesting that Governor Sununu has expressed a philosophy of educational funding that the money should follow the student, which is the main principle underlying the Freedom Scholarship Bill for elementary education, that the grant's not going to the school, it's going to the student and their family, and they can pick whatever school they want to go to. So we're not funding religious schools, we're giving money to kids and families. This scholarship program gives the money to the schools.
Right, it's more direct. Yeah.
Directly, right. To be then doled out. And it's not prorated on the basis of enrollment or anything. UNH gets the same chunk for their four-year programs as every other 4 years, and the 2 years get a reduced amount and so forth. So it is going through the schools. The philosophy behind it is we need to keep young people here, and if they go to school here, there's more likely they'll stay here. There is no enforcement mechanism. It's a $2,000 scholarship, which is really a drop in the bucket for a year's worth of college.
At least for some of these schools.
For most of them.
Yeah.
And so the notion that I got a $2,000 scholarship, even if I got it every one of my 4 years, the scholarship money itself isn't going to be a retention factor. The theory that because you went to UNH or Plymouth or any of the schools that you will stay in New Hampshire after graduation, statistics kind of show that that's what happens. So there is some empirical basis for that assumption. But whether that will be the way it plays out depends on a lot of factors, including how attractive New Hampshire remains to those graduates on a number of criteria after they get their diploma.
Also in the news this week, the Senate rejected a bill that would have rolled back requirements that are needed to be a school nurse. Jason, what were those requirements?
The requirements that are in place now, they include that nurses have kind of a specific background in public health, and I think it's 3 years' experience in a pediatric setting. These were put into place just a few years ago. It's in sort of recognition of a growing list of responsibilities for school nurses. I know we've had some great reporting, in just the past couple of years about how school nurses are now kind of on the front lines of, the opioid crisis, for instance, and kind of a bevy of other issues that you might not necessarily think about when you picture a school nurse in your mind. So these requirements were added a couple of years ago, but the pushback has been from districts who say they're having a hard time now filling the positions. So larger school districts like Manchester, as well as places in the North Country where there's just a staffing shortage and, for all kinds of positions. And they say you add these requirements, it's going to be that much harder to fill these. Ultimately, the Senate rejected the bill, so the requirements remain in place, although there was a change made elsewhere that gives school nurses more time to meet those requirements. So I think it's 6 years now, so they have to kind of get the extra credits they need to satisfy all the requirements. So they see that as a sort of compromise to keep the requirements in place but give people more time to get there.
Okay. A couple more stories to discuss this week. One is a new report by the AP found that there were 8 complaints of sexual harassment in the New Hampshire House, 6 people involved there. But is this necessarily new? Dean, is this a new information that we're learning?
We've certainly been talking about the issue a lot more in recent months and getting a better understanding of what the limitations are on the state legislature in terms of how they deal with this. This was an AP research project. They requested in all states to try to identify cases of sexual harassment. They came back with, I think, 70 cases nationwide. And as you mentioned, New Hampshire had 8 complaints involving 6 members of the House. Now, the issue with this is sort of the record keeping is voluntary. The Senate doesn't even have records, so we're only looking at House data. And if you read the reporting on this, it just sounds like not a lot happened, which I think underscores the issue of the state legislature having to confront how to deal with this issue in a more effective manner.
Okay.
These five incidents have been reported on in the past, and not to diminish them, but none of them were criminal or even the quid pro quo kind of situations. The more concerning situation regarding sexual harassment in the legislature, at least in the House, seems to be the lack to which the matter is taken very seriously among a large portion of lawmakers. I think 30% of them have not returned a simple statement signed that they've read the sexual harassment policy. Mm-hmm. Some of the more conservative lawmakers even orchestrated a campaign urging their peers not to sign that they've read the sexual harassment policy. And when the House scheduled a sexual harassment training session a few months ago, there was only a handful of reps that showed up for it. So I think the greater problem is a lack of willingness to acknowledge that this is a matter that needs to be embraced and not treated dismissively.
Mm-hmm. Final story, because we always tend to end on a story related to animals. The New Hampshire Red is poised to become the official state poultry. Haven't seen an official state blank piece of legislation in a while, I guess. And Dave, there's kind of a discussion on whether or not these things should still keep happening, even though the kids seem to enjoy and benefit from helping to push this legislation.
It's always a discussion. There's a faction in the House that just has an aversion to this notion that the legislative process should be used as a method of instructive engagement in politics by school children, where every
should
year—
Should school children, by the way, introduce this legislation or—
I'm sorry.
Or
yeah, every year there's a bill that's introduced by a class somewhere to designate a state fruit, reptile, flower, some type of activity, whatever have you. And it's largely done as by way of education, which obviously a majority of lawmakers have found to be a worthwhile endeavor because these bills come forth every year and they're improved. They have set the stage for some pretty bizarre debates in recent years. But overall, I think the Senate has tried to rein this in by putting a 1 or 2 year limit on the effectiveness of these designations, both to allow for reconsideration and perhaps to allow for enough room to future classrooms to engage in the exercise, because eventually we'll run out of flowers, reptiles, and chickens.
So the New Hampshire Red will be term limited in some way.
This one isn't.
Okay.
That's
so far,
become
right.
A debate. Why isn't this one limited?
This is
what we've come to
on
these issues.
Worth noting that the governor does seem to support this one, so we'll leave it at that. But I want to thank our guests for being on the show today. Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, the union leaders Dave Solomon and NHPR's Jason Moon. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here.
Thanks, Peter.
I want to mention that we do have all the stories that we've discussed today at nhpr.org. You can continue the conversation on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. This is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.